Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today it's feasting through 1,000 years of civilization, feasting with the people of the corn. We're taking you to Mexico City. From stunning moles to street tacos to delicious antigs to cooking with Mexican doyenne Diana Kennedy, we did it all on our recent Mexican trip. We have the taste, the sounds, and the generosity of local experts. A food historian talks eating with the Aztecs and the modern dinner plate as class structure. Diana Kennedy opens her Mexican eco house to us with a lesson in authenticity. We learn about the return of women's food, the craft of the great taco al pastor, and the power of a simple bowl of corn. All this and much more coming up on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. Well, today it's eating in Mexico City. We're back from a week of total culinary immersion, and I haven't been this excited since my first trip to Paris. Now, I know something of Mexican food, but even as a lover of history, I didn't appreciate the breadth of civilization backing each dish that we tasted. And the size of the place. Mexico City covers 3,000 square miles. That is the size of two Rhode Islands. Flying in at night, I could swear I could see the curve of the earth. And then there are the warnings. Don't drink the water. Don't eat the street food. Don't take taxis unless they're the right colors with the right badges. Well, that was the first taboo that we trashed. We stepped out of the terminal into chaos. Taxi lines were snaking back to the Texas border, and there wasn't a sign of our promised ride. So, taxi, it had to be. One producer, one tech director, one show host, and luggage were stuffed into a clown car. We had arrived in DF, District Federal, what Mexicans call Mexico City. Well, the next morning, we met the food lover's guardian angel, Ruth Alegria. I don't think that there's a food, a cook, or a good place to eat in that city that Ruth doesn't know about. Ruth was to be our wheels and our informant. Now, that first morning, she had a plan, initiation by total immersion, a visit to the huge Jamaica market. Now, you have to picture a vast sprawl of sheds and shacks jammed up against each other, Christmas lights and giant piñatas everywhere. And if there is a food or a flower in Mexico, it is sold here.
These are different atoles. These are drinks. That's why they're cups. Drinks. They're drinks. And the atole is, a pre-Hispanic beverage, though, that has evolved right over the years because there's now refined sugar, there are flavorings. The rice is usually an horchata or a rice blend, right, and the darker one is usually chocolate, or it can be canela, cinnamon, or cajeta, which is the burnt goat's milk.
The atole, is that the correct way to pronounce it?
Yes.
This is so interesting because these are four, what look like four terracotta, very large terracotta
pots,
jugs.
Yeah.
And they're wrapped.
To keep the heat in. They've been put over super high heat. This is your original thermos.
This is, it is as though someone has turned neon lights on inside of all of this food. I mean, it glows, the intensity of it, tiny little oranges, large grapefruits, what look like might be small guava or passion fruit, but everything in orange and gold and yellow, and they all sort of vibrate. They're beautifully laid out.
We don't really need farm markets because apart from the regular mercados or the marketplaces that are within buildings, every week, every neighborhood has a tianguis. And a tianguis is a pre-Hispanic word that means a market. Every week, every major neighborhood has a tianguis. Do you see what she's making? This is called a guajolote. You know what a guajolote is? A turkey. And that is what the sandwich is known as. And this little boy just got a sweet one because I can see it's pink.
It's pink?
Yes.
And so that's going to be what then?
That's almost like a dessert. But children can have whatever they want here. So if he wants dessert before he has anything else, he can have it.
I wonder if that isn't true in all Latin countries.
Oh, even more so here. Children, sometimes you'll hear parents speaking to their children. Ay, mi princesito, my little prince, what happened? Did someone frighten you? Oh, no, no. Children are absolutely the most incredibly wonderful treasure here. Beautiful mushroom. Oh, look at that.
Oh,
is that absolutely incredible?
Yeah.
Corn smut. You take it off the cob, and then you just give it a slight rinse. You dry it well. You chop up a little onion, garlic, and this, and you saute
like
it. And then a little epazote at the end, and you make quesadillas or... muchas gracias.
Ruth, what is this? What have I
seen? Raspado. It's a shaved ice. You used to have them. Do you remember them years ago in the United States?
Yes,
you'd have
yes.
someone running around, and then they'd pour the syrups.
Right.
But these are homemade syrups, and some of them, I would think, are mango. I mean, she's got lime.
Looks like lemon with the rind on there.
Yeah, so these are all homemade. Ay, mira. Qué bonito.
Gracias. Gracias.
Muchas gracias.
We've and just been handed a shaved ice with this bright green syrup by a young woman who overheard us talking about it, just as a gift.
It's nice and sweet. Want a lick? You have a lick.
But now this is something I'm wondering about. Was sugar historically seen as something that was really precious?
Yes, because the only sweeteners that they had pre-conquest were honey, and any natural sugars that they could derive from other sugar cane. But once sugar hit these shores, my God, did you have pan dulce this morning, sweet bread?
Yes, I did.
I just want to point out, everything here is intertwined, religion, food, luck, and it all has pre-Hispanic origins.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This is the chicharron stand, the fried pork stand, and there's peanuts mixed with grasshopper, and then there's just grasshopper that people are nibbling the way you would eat a nut. This is fried pork rind, and it's on a tortilla. And it's crunchy. It's really crunchy. Oh, my. You've got to. You've got to taste this. Now there's a green chili. Is it tomatillo? It's a green sauce that is just sitting in a mojete, a three-legged mortar that's been made by hand. And you drizzle that over the airy, crispy, sort of blistered pork rind, and then you bite. Mmm. That was Ruth Alegría leading us through the Jamaica Market in Mexico City. From raucous color to utter tranquility, Ruth delivered us to Restaurant El Cardenal. It's a Mexico City institution. Classic food, unsullied by modern-day fusion, El Cardenal is all about regional specialties. And very old ones, too, like the Aztec starter of escamoles. Ant eggs coddled in butter, eaten with tiny tortillas. Frankly, they were crunchy and delicious, but they tasted more of butter than of ant. There was this cool, hot, tart green salsa that was smeared on tiny tortillas and wrapped around fresh cheese. Ancho chilies were buried under a pile of pork and red Oaxacan mole. And then there was natas. This is a clotted cream that you eat by dipping in sticks of sweetbread. And then there was jerked beef in vinegar and garlic. And in case we were still feeling a little peaked, there was a flan tasting, goat versus cow. The days of the combination plate were definitely behind us. Mexico is revaluing her native food. Ricardo Munoz must be partially responsible. He gained great regard in Mexico for his exhaustive encyclopedia of Mexican foods. And his Café Azul y Oro at the National University of Mexico is situated there because his goal is to give students a taste of their culinary heritage. We got to the restaurant early enough for the last of his breakfast hot chocolate, yet late enough for lunch. The food began to appear. Squash blossom omelets and black beans, tamales of Swiss chard and banana leaves, a black mole enchilada wrapped around nuts, olives, and fruits. More Moorish than Mexican, as Ricardo said. As he explained the dishes, we talked of his research into early foods.
What was the food like here in Mexico before the Spaniards came in the 1500s?
Well, we know a lot, but on the other hand, we know very little, because we have to remember that the codex were destroyed by the Spaniards as a part of
the records.
The Aztecs, they kept all the information very carefully, and they knew the classification of the plants and the mushrooms and the animals, all the things that they were edible. They have a very strict classification, and we know now for sure, but unfortunately, a lot of those informations that we have, they were destroyed in the process of the colonization. But we know that there are a lot of things that we are still eating nowadays, such as the tortillas, such as the cactus, such as a lot of edible flowers, like squash blossoms, squashes, different kinds of beans, of course, corn, and many others. One of the things that makes Mexican cooking very unique from the other cookies of the world is this is a cooking that it was developed by itself.
So it was until the Spaniards came completely isolated?
Right.
I'd like to talk a little bit about class and food in Mexico. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, different social classes all over the world eat differently.
Right.
How has that played in the restaurant scene here in Mexico?
Here is a true melange, and it's quite interesting. One of the most popular things in Mexico is the tacos, for example.
Yes.
But those are very inexpensive, so everybody has the chance to go at least once. And sometimes I explain this, that in the tacos is where you get to see the real Mexico, because even though the upper classes, that they usually go to a fine dining restaurants, they eventually come to the taquerias, and then you will see next to each other rich and poor, and you will see all kinds of cars from Mercedes to Volkswagens in the parking lots.
I just see in walking through the market, we've been to only two markets, so I'm new to this, but I see so many different forms of corn, for instance.
Right.
I've tasted in a few days so many different versions of mole, that wonderful sauce. It just seems as though this is so much a part of the earth here, of the mentality here.
And things that they haven't changed for centuries. We are eating things that they haven't changed a bit. It's very, 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 very little.
Amazing, amazing. Ricardo, thank you so much for talking with us.
No, thank you. It was a pleasure having you here.
Ricardo Munoz is author of the Encyclopedia of Mexican Ingredients, which will be republished in Spanish in the summer of 2009. Now, for information on the restaurants we found in Mexico City, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Cooking with Diana Kennedy, the Arab tradition Mexicans enjoy every day, and the new food of Mexico City. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The idea of going to Mexico began with an invite to lunch. cookbook author and maybe the expert on Mexican food, Diana Kennedy, invited us to cook lunch with her at her Mexican house. Now, for those devoted to authentic Mexican food, Diana Kennedy is something between a rock star and a deity. Adjectives like uncompromising, dedicated, driven, and beloved come to mind. The woman is definitely worth the journey. 2 hours out of Mexico City, you go from village street to dirt road to cow track to goat path to her house. Literally built into a wooded hillside, there is an outcropping of boulders in her living room. And then there's Diana, small, in her 80s, still beautiful, and so vibrant there's a force field around her. The four of us are shepherded into the kitchen. Breakfast is set out on the table in front of the fireplace. Diana has been cooking all weekend. There are homemade pastries and her homegrown coffee. They're waiting there while the breakfast tamales are steaming.
Now, who would like raw coffee? Because I'll put another small cup of tea.
No. Are you all right? You're going to eat your bun? Okay. Right.
I have done my duty.
All right.
Excellent.
All right. Now, in a few minutes, there'll be a tamale.
Diana's in constant motion, sitting in squeaky leather chairs in that kitchen with the windows wide open to the wild garden. We talk about everything, from politics to how to properly slake corn in lime to her seminal book, The Cuisines of Mexico.
But I remember when Cuisines came out and looking at it and thinking, you will put this in the bookcase and the day's going to come when you're going to be ready for this. And I can't say that I worked my way through the entire book, but I learned so much. And, you know, it was also, quite frankly, one of the things that I held up as a, if I'm going to ever do a book, let it be, of this kind of book, as opposed to yet another collection of recipes.
The thing is, the time has come when people say, well, you review a book. I certainly won't review any Mexican book. I'm sorry, I won't, because and nobody has done the wandering around any country. And I am rather tired of young people, Mexican chefs and women and men, who say, well, she's English. I'm Mexican. I cooked with my grandmother. Well, you know, when I came to Mexico, they were this high, and I was cooking with their grandmothers. And I want this to be broadcast because I get a little tired of it, you know. Who has spent all this time trolling around the country? I mean, I've never made any money, obviously, because, I mean, I did manage to build this house, which is great. Because I didn't want to popularize it. You know, how about a low-cal microwave Mexican cookbook? No way! I would die! I would die! And, you know, this English accent can do two things. And mostly people, so superior. No. I don't consider myself. I would love to have done a better job. I'd love to have had better books. I would love to have not been so uptight when I was teaching. That's why I was scared, because I was so uptight, because I wanted to do the best.
Was part of it, too, that you knew how much you didn't know?
Of course. Of course. Still, I know how much I don't know. God, when people say, oh, she's there, I think, my God, but there's so much more to learn. And now I've got a horrible memory, and I can, even if I can forget food things, I think, oh, my God, that's the worst. If I can forget the name of a food dish or the botanical name of a herb I use every day, I mean, that's quite shocking, you know. But I got to the age when, you know, I'm going to fail.
So when you came here, I mean, was it something as though, you know, it dropped out of the sky and suddenly you knew you wanted to know more?
Yeah.
Or did it happen gradually?
No. I mean, right away I looked at these markets and said, oh, my God, I've got to cook. And and then the little cleaning woman, as I said, my thing was dragged in. You forget the cleaning, you know. Let's make tamales.
How old were you at that time?
I was in my 30s. I'm old.
No, you're not. No. And you were a mere baby in your 30s. So just, but
yeah, I think I was really very unsophisticated.
Were people surprised by you? I'm speaking now of the Mexicans.
Oh, yes, I thought I was sort of weirdo. I think, you know, coming out and speaking extremely bad Spanish. But they were very generous. Mexicans are very generous.
Mm-hmm.
They really are. And only with one notable exception have people refused to give me a recipe. Now, they may have left something out, but if I'm there in the kitchen, I usually catch it. Or I realize now if something's left out, because with so much experience.
Eventually, we pulled ourselves away from the table and moved outside. Now, when Diana bought this isolated place, she quickly realized that she was going to have to be pretty self-sufficient. She saves water every way that she can, from tanks capturing rainwater to a recycling system that uses the gravity of the hillside to filter wastewater for growing food. On the patio outside the kitchen, reflectors are set up to warm water and heat plates for meals. Her commitment to being light on this earth is everywhere. Nimble as a goat, Diana leads us down a steep cobbled path.
Now, we'll go down to see the kitchen garden.
Now, this is a woven wood
this
gate.
This is homemade gate. And look at the hinges are made of old tires. I mean, I just love this recycling bit. And then we have bananas. Now, I will occasionally get some good bananas. Not banana country, although Carlos, a little bit further down in the village, has beautiful bananas. But he does this, so I have lots of leaves for tamales.
So that
type of tamale.
Yeah.
Okay. And then chayote will be all over here. Now, the garden is just
so
picking up.
Artichokes. Uh-huh.
Just picking up after the rainy season when everything is devastated.
So what are we seeing here? We've got rows, slightly raised beds, dark brown dirt.
And the dirt is being reinforced with, of course, the compost and stuff like that. Now, it's very interesting. You are going in your green pozole. The traditional is to have a sour grass, really. But very nicely, Carlos has taken the wild sorrel, which is the original for this recipe, and planted it. So we've got plenty.
That's what we're seeing in those long, verdant green leaves.
Yes, it's a rumex. I decided the other day, a few months ago, to take all the seeds in my kitchen spices and sow them. I want to see what every plant looks like growing. You do realize how we don't know what.
You're right. You're right. I'm thinking of all the seeds I have.
Yeah.
You have a
radish,
line of cactus. You know, there are three or four corn plants. Now, are you growing those for the leaves?
No, I mean, he just put them in. I never know what's going in. Now, Carlos is in command, and I never know. And there's a.
That garden's a wild mishmash. She makes no attempt to tame it. She plants around the wild. Prince Charles evidently came for a visit once, and the thought of this gentleman wandering those wild beds is hilarious. Well, Diana grows wheat, coffee, corn, and her corn will be lunch. She's going to teach us to make pozole, stewed corn and pork with a green sauce. Diana started days ago when she took her dried corn, she soaked it in water mixed with mineral lime to loosen the skins, and then took each kernel and picked off the hard bit where the kernel meets the cob. Well, she had help, she admits. She recommends roping in a neighbor boy. We head back to the kitchen where the corn has been simmering in water with pork. It's waiting in a beer belly-sized clay pot.
So now what are you doing?
I've got ahead and I've cooked the maíz or the
corn.
Solero.
Yeah.
And then I put it to cook with pork, and I got a pork shank and also some pork belly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's cooking with the thing.
Where is this dish from in Mexico?
This is from Chilapa Guerrero, and it's usually served for some reason on a Thursday. Now, it may be because Wednesday night they killed the pigs. I don't know. They're famous for their big breakfast dish or almuerzo dish, is pozole.
And now the next step. So
the next step now is to put the seasoning or the green stuff that goes into the green pozole. Now I have shelled pepitas or pumpkin seeds, and you want raw, unsalted ones.
May I taste it?
Yeah.
Just taste one.
And then that'll be toasted. I don't want it to change color, but I want them to start swelling up. So I've got to watch this. I don't want them to burn. Now, these are getting nice and hot. Don't want them to change color.
So you're actually just putting your hands in there. Yeah. Oh, I can hear them, too. Yeah. They're in a cast iron skillet.
So we don't want them to be anything further than that. I'm now going to let them cool off before I grind them, because otherwise, you know, the oil exudes and your blades will seize up.
Uh-huh.
The pumpkin seeds cool and are ground in a coffee grinder. Diana cooks down tomatillos with a little water. They went into the blender, along with wild sorrel leaves, serrano chilies, and water.
Put a little bit more in, but I don't want too much. You never take seeds out of a serrano. Now, anybody who does that doesn't know Mexican food, and the books who say it, you could throw the book away, all right?
Other chilies you would see.
Oh, yes, of course. No, I'm doing what is done in Mexico.
Right.
I mean, it's
right.
Crazy to take seeds. The seeds are so good for you. Yes, of course. If you're doing dried chilies, going to tradition, of course you take seeds out, right?
Yeah.
With exceptions. There are exceptions to every rule. But I'm just doing what I have learned over the years. It's not being opinionated. It's being, I am recording. It's not my opinion. It's the thing. Okay?
Well, the thing you said a while ago, which people don't perhaps understand, these are not your recipes.
They're not, no.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be anywhere if it weren't for the generosity of Mexican cooks who have shared their recipes with me. You see? Yeah, I'm going to put a bit more in.
So you've put a heaping tablespoon of lard in there.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're adding the ground pumpkin seeds to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the natural thickener, and it's more flavor.
Okay, gracias, Conce.
Oh, it's getting really thick, and it's bubbling.
Yeah, now I hope it's
like blistering almost over the top.
Yeah.
Now, what are you smelling for?
You want a raw flavor out of there.
Ah.
So now you're going to scrape every bit of that puree.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I never waste a damn thing. That's great. And this goes in.
Okay. Oh, Diana, it smells so good. You can smell that sweet, flowery smell of the corn that's been treated with the lime and the richness of the meat. And tasting that puree, that cooked puree, it's still very, very tart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then to go with this.
No, this is it.
This is it.
No, you never serve anything with it.
Mm-hmm.
No, this is it.
We move outside to the table on the patio. One of the dogs is let out. We carry garnishes and drinks. Diana has warmed clay bowls in her solar oven. That beer belly pot of pozole goes to Diana's place so that she can ladle out our lunch. Bowls are passed, and I get my spoon in for a taste.
Okay, dear, help yourself to the bits.
Okay,
please.
So we've got the chopped onion, chopped chili, diced avocado, the chicharrone, the pork rind, and then fresh lime.
All the crispy bits. Now, it's a little bit diluted. I would have liked it just a bit stronger in flavor, no?
Diana, this is absolutely delicious. Thank you so much for inviting us.
Oh, well, delighted you came. So many years, Lynn.
I know, but we finally did it.
Now tell me if you don't want the...
That was the incomparable Diana Kennedy. Diana's done many books on Mexican food, all worth a good thumbing. Now, the pozole recipe is from The Art of Mexican Cooking, and you can find the recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. Back in Mexico City, I looked up a woman I had wanted to meet for a long time. Rachel Loudon is a history professor turned food historian. Now, she's been living in Mexico about 10 years, researching a book on the world history of food. I thought with the perspective this research gives her, it would be interesting to learn how she sees Mexican foods. Rachel,
everywhere we've gone, we've seen stands selling this fruit water. And it's served with all the meals that we've had. It's called agua fresca. But there must be a tradition behind this.
There is a truly ancient tradition behind it. It came to Mexico with the conquistadors in the 16th century. And before that, it was in Spain. And before that, it was the common property of the Islamic world. Don't forget that Spain was a part of the Islamic world
at the point
when the conquistadors left. And it is, I agree with you, one of the most wonderful traditions in Mexico.
So what would have been its origins in the Islamic world?
It was a non-alcoholic drink that made use of this wonderful newly discovered substance, sugar, and you combine sugar with nuts or fruits or flowers to make these drinks to accompany meals or to have by themselves.
It almost tastes like the great-great-grandfather of sodas.
Yes, sodas and squashes come from this probably originally, though of course now they've been carbonated and they don't taste fresh. The wonderful things about these in Mexico is they're made fresh every morning. And I'm, at the moment, trying to accumulate an agua fresca for every week of the year, and I don't think there will be any problem doing
that. That much variety?
Certainly there wouldn't be any problem getting 50 different agua frescas.
So what kinds of... Can you reel off some?
Okay, well, start off with all the citrus ones. Limonada, naranjada, that's orange. You can make agua fresca of the leaves of lime trees. You can make agua fresca with the entire lime or just with the juice. You can add chia seeds into it, which give you little glutinous globes, which are absolutely delicious. There's another whole big family based on tamarind. There's another whole big family called horchata, that is sometimes based on almonds, sometimes on coconuts, sometimes on rice, sometimes on oatmeal. That's kind of milky. You can make it from mangoes. You can make it from melons. You can make it from tropical fruits, flowers, like the water we're drinking right now is agua de Jamaica. That is made from a flower. It's part of the hibiscus family, but don't try it with the hibiscus in your backyard.
Okay. Well, we may die. All right. And it's beautiful. It's
it's gorgeous.
Cherry.
Yes.
Clear cherry. Is there ever a medicinal connection here?
Yes, there would have been, in the sense that all foods were medicinal and sugar was clearly a medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And many of these you will find balancing. The sugar would have been hot and dry, and that would have balanced the cold lime. You can add pepper or ginger into limonada, and that will warm it up too.
And that's going back to that theory,
the humoral theory.
The humoral theory, where it was, there were the four humors, or
yes.
The, yeah.
Yes.
I always think of them as hot water, cold water, cool and cloudy, but they're not.
No.
It was hot,
cold, wet and dry. Yes.
And that all of us, our bodies were balanced in,
yes, exactly.
With all of those.
Yes. And this is a very nice balance between warm, dry sugar and cold, wet fruit.
So that would help keep your body
in balance.
In
yes.
Balance. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Historian Rachel Loudon lives in Mexico. Now, you can find more information on Rachel on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, women's food finally makes the big time, Mexico City's new Mexico cuisine, and late-night tacos. I'm Lynn Rosetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rosetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. This is a special show on our recent trip to Mexico City. Human nature is a quirky beast. Sometimes the best we have is what we ignore. Now, for years in Mexico City, the affluent ate out at French or Italian restaurants, never at Mexican ones. Well, now Mexican food is hot in Mexico City. And part of the reason is a group of women chefs, educated women who moved into the upscale restaurant scene and brought back traditions. One of them is Chef Margarita Carrillo de Salinas. She has restaurants in Mexico and Japan. She works with university researchers in examining the origins of Mexican foods, and she champions women's work in the professional kitchen.
Margarita, you've got this explosion from what you're describing to me of interest in traditional food. How is this affecting the women who are coming out of the indigenous population, the native peoples?
Well, this is good for them, because now they have the opportunity to work in professional restaurants, in professional cuisines, mm-hmm. in restaurants. And there is this like a phenomenon in Mexico. It's a grade for women working in restaurant cuisines that are called mayoras. Mayora is the highest rank a woman can have in a professional kitchen in Mexico.
So she is not called a chef.
No, because they are not chefs. They are mayoras. Many of them don't know how to read or write. They have the traditional food in their hands because uh-huh. they have been inheriting this from generations.
Yeah.
But they are humble indigenous women. They will never be chefs because this is a tradition in Mexico. The highest rank they can get is mayores. They earn more. They control the kitchen. The chef has to ask them for permission to do things.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, in Mexican traditional structure, family structure, women are very strong. And this is like a family. Everybody has to ask Mayora for permission for whatever. She cooks for the staff, and she decides who takes a day off, who doesn't take a day off. You know, they are the boss in professional Mexican restaurants.
Are they cooking for the customers as well?
Yes, of course.
But they can never be a chef.
No.
And no. They can never earn as a chef might earn.
Not much, but they earn good uh-huh. money. So they support the family. This is something good for indigenous women. So they can come out of their homes and cook outside and teach us and the whole world what they do. You know, our food is completely mingled with our culture and our religion.
Tell me about convent food.
Well, we had, at the colony time, we had a lot of, a big immigration of religious priests and uh-huh. nuns. And nuns, you know, normally they have nothing to do but pray and cook. So they cooked great food because they had indigenous servants. And also, high-class families in Mexico mm-hmm. used to send their daughters to the convents, either to be nuns or to be prepared to be married.
So they became almost culinary centers.
Yes. And they mixed with the traditional Spanish recipe, Mexican ingredients, and Mexican hands, Mexican indigenous hands, making the dishes. So the result is fantastic.
All over the world now, we're seeing essentially traditions being almost set aside and all this innovation. What are your thoughts about it here in Mexico?
Well, I personally, I don't know if because I'm too old, but I don't agree with this. I think that these young guys that are cooking these new dishes, they don't master the basics. They first have to master all the basics, know perfectly well all the ingredients, and then they have to earn the right to deconstruct our traditional food that has been here for centuries.
What are the basics?
The basics?
Here.
In Mexico? All the moles, sauces, pipianes, and mastering the handling of chiles. You know, in Mexico, we have more than 100 different chiles, and they are not all of them are spicy. They have just different flavors. You use them for different things, and it's not a question of, oh, we'll put a little bit chipotle and we'll make this recipe Mexican and modern.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Mm-hmm.
You have to respect the traditional dishes.
So your requirement is, before I can innovate or change, yeah. I got to master every one of those dishes
yes.
in addition to
yes.
all the foundation.
Or don't touch the traditional dishes.
Margarita, thanks so much for talking with us.
You are very welcome. Thank you for being interested in the culture of my country, the real thing, and the food. I beg you, try the real Mexican food.
We will.
Chef Margarita Carrillo de Salinas has restaurants in Mexico and Japan and works with the organization helping Mexican women develop their professional cooking skills. We stepped out of the car after another harrowing drive through Mexico City traffic and stepped into peace. We'd arrived at Pujol, the restaurant of Chef Enrique Olvera. Now, when you ask people who is reinventing Mexican food, it is this chef and this restaurant people tell you about, and with great opinion, I might add. We meet up with Enrique in the kitchen. He looks about 30, wearing jeans with a down vest and a plaid shirt. He trained at the Culinary Institute of America, and he's worked all over the world, only to return to his home. So, Enrique, what drives your food?
Memory, by all means. Our food is an interpretation on contemporary Mexican dishes. And by contemporary, what I mean is that it's dishes that are present in the streets of Mexico. It's what Mexicans eat every day. Uh-huh. It's not necessarily the Mexican food that is in the books, but the food that actually people eat. So esquites, tacos al pastor, milanesas, albóndigas. Uh-huh. And then the presentation is a little bit more sophisticated. So the idea is also that you feel proud and that Mexicans finally believe that our food deserves to be in a fine dining ambience, because a lot of Mexicans and foreigners as well think that Mexican food is something very casual and food that is street food and that is great, but that is meant to be enjoyed in a very casual context. And we believe that cilantro has the same value as foie gras. The fact that one is $6 a kilo mm-hmm. and the other one is $1,000 a kilo doesn't make it different. No, it's still a living thing that needs respect and has certain attributes, and you should treat it with the same respect.
Is Mexican food seen by Mexicans as something that's humble, something that would not be elevated in a restaurant like yours?
This train of thought used to be true. I think that things are changing little by little, and that we are finally accepting, as the Spaniards did a couple decades ago, that our food is up to par with the great haute cuisines of the world. And the fact that a good handmade tortilla can be as sublime as a great baguette in Paris. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No? See, if you understand that and you appreciate that, then you understand our whole concept.
I have to remark, this kitchen is very small. This is the size of a bedroom,
of a small bedroom.
Yeah.
But also the restaurant is 48 seats. And I also believe that the great cook doesn't need a huge kitchen. You need mm-hmm. a solid knife, good sauté pans, and a good stove.
It's interesting because in many kitchens here in Mexico City, I have seen women, mayores, in the kitchen. But here, these are young men. So do you have women as well on the
staff? We have most, because transportation system in Mexico is not that good, most of our PM staff is male, because they go out late at night and they have to take the transport and it's as safe. Most of the staff in the morning are women, so it's
so the influence
it's a balance,
is there.
No? But we don't hire based on that.
Enrique, there are two signs on the wall of the kitchen that I'd love for you to translate. One has the rays of the sun. Can you translate that for me?
Yes, this is a phrase from the Ritz-Carlton philosophy that says that we're ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen. And it basically talks about people, and what is important is people, not the stars. We don't want to be a 3 Michelin star restaurant.
Uh-huh.
We want that all the customers that come to Pujol have a great experience, that they come out and say, what a wonderful experience, I want to go back, or this was the best mole de olla that I had in my life. That kind of a thing mm-hmm. is the expectations we have. We're not here for the stars.
There's a quote from Aristotle. Could you translate it for me?
Yeah, we have that in all of the kitchens. Basically, it means that excellence is a habit. It's not a virtue. And that to achieve that excellence, you need to do it every day. It's not something that you were born with. It's something that you train yourself every day. And then underneath is my cell phone. So cooks can call me anytime. I always tell them, there's my cell phone if you have a problem, if you have a question, if I'm traveling and you have any concern, you can call me.
That's great.
Thanks so much for having us in the kitchen.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Muchas gracias.
Enrique Olvera is chef owner of Restaurant Pujol in Mexico City. And as though to prove his statement about street food, he served us his version of one of the first things that we ate at that market on our first day, a fresh corn stew called esquites. Now, at the market, it was a field corn that was just in season at that moment, cooked in corn broth with chili. It was so direct, pure corn, utterly fresh. At Pujol, three corns came in three dainty piles in a bowl, purple, white, and pozole corn. And then a hot, clarified corn broth was poured in. The same elements, similar tastes, higher definition. Better than the market? No, but different. Pujol is a place you need to lead up to. To get Enrique's cooking, you've got to eat tradition first. Do not go to Mexico City unless you know how to snack. Everybody eats all the time, and sweets are king. Ruth Alegría took us to the queen of all bakeries in the historic center of town. And queen is literal. The place feels royal. Vast space, high ceilings, gothic vaulting, gilt and mirrors, and table after table of every imaginable cookie, pastry, bun, biscuit, roll, loaf, and cream-filled goodie. This place is like a cathedral.
Now, we're on the first floor of La Ideal Pastelería, La Ideal Pastry Shop, which is in the Centro Histórico. This is actually a destination panadería, pastelería. Here you can buy all kinds of sweetbreads.
So how does this work? How does this work?
Take your round pizza pan, take your tongs, you go around, and you pick what you want. Then you come to the cashier. She makes the ticket for you. You pay, and then you go and pick up your pastries.
Your bundle.
Your bundle.
Oh,
yes,
this is that buttered bread with the sugar on top of it. Yes. And these look...
These are called Marías. You know, everything is a variation of either puff pastry, a sweetbread pastry, an egg yolk pastry, sugars, creams, butters. There is a second floor to this absolutely gorgeous building, which is probably an 18th century building. The
right.
Second floor is devoted to your special occasion cakes. And this can be a wedding, a baptism, a confirmation, a first Holy Communion.
We make the long march up a set of sweeping marble stairs and reach the top. It's a forest of cakes, towering over us, in unbelievable colors and shapes. There are gobs of dripping frosting, sculpted swags, day-glow colors, and in sizes that can't be imagined. I am talking cakes that could feed 300 people. The chandeliers that are hanging from 18-foot ceilings are covered in frosting, left over from cakes being moved.
This, you know what this reminds me of? Alice in Wonderland? Every cake is marked with kilos, 28 kilos.
Yes, that's about, 52 pounds?
You buy it by the pound.
Yes.
They're almost bizarre to our eyes.
It makes me want to get married.
You can visit the monuments and definitely go to the museums, but you've got to come to this place and see this wedding cake first. Ruth, thanks.
You're welcome.
As you can tell, we did try and do our duty in Mexico City. The eating is endless and it's irresistible. But again and again, we were told that the culinary heart of Mexico is the taco. Ruth took us to her neighborhood taqueria. 10 o'clock at night, we're just getting hungry after our late lunch. It was jammed. Everyone drinking beer with lime. A street singer is accompanying himself on a guitar. Cars are pulling up to do take home. It is happening, and it smells delicious.
A real taco is a circular tortilla that's perhaps 3 inches wide. That's all.
It's not that big flapjack that we see so often. You know, they're usually 8-9 inches in diameter.
Nothing like it here. When you say a taco here, you're not talking about a fried shell. A taco is just a soft tortilla that's folded over with a filling. And here, of course, it's meat.
Right.
The specialty of the house, Madame,
yes,
is a taco al pastor. And we're sitting right next to the pastor spit. And it is what most Americans would know as a gyro.
torahiro. And it's a spit on which pounded out pork that's been marinated in achote or anado. And then you stack it on the gyro spit. You put onions. As you can see, there are whole onions here. Not everyone does whole onions. Yeah. And then a pineapple so that the juices can flow over it.
So what should I order?
Oh, my God, we don't have enough time again. There's not enough time. We should all order something different, and thank goodness that there are four of us.
Y cuando ese milagro realiza el prodigio de amarse.
That was instant. We ordered, and it's here. Okay. So we've got the meat and onion and cilantro. Mmm. And pineapple. That's amazing. Pineapple. This is great. Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm so happy that I could bring you here for tacos.
Could I have two more, please?
Y cuando ese milagro realiza el prodigio de amarse.
We're at Taqueria El Tizoncito in Mexico City with Ruth Alegría. And by the way, in a week of nonstop eating, we did not see one flour tortilla. They are done in northern Mexico and in the United States. Well, that's our visit to Mexico City. Now, for information on the people we met and where we ate, check out the website, splendidtable.org. Well, thanks for joining us. And until next week, let me leave you with this from an anonymous source. I went to Mexico for a magic that does not exist in any other country. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. You will find information on almost everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And there's more. Not only will you find newsletters and podcasts, you will find information on our book, How to Eat Supper. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our Mexican adventure was recorded and edited by the very flexible and competent Chris Hegel, who developed a special walking cane technique for the recording of this show. Special thanks to Ruth Alegría for opening doors and sharing boundless enthusiasm for her beloved city, and Food Authority Lila Lomeli, the Mexican Tourism Board, and the Sheridan Maria Isabel. Our program is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau and Jennifer Larson. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Brett Baldwin. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.